Hey guys, welcome back to part two of episode 99 of Unknown Passage, a podcast that tells the stories of those who have gone missing or have been murdered abroad. So I'll say this again at the start of this part. Episode 100 is next week, and I'm putting out the call for anyone who wants to download the Anchor app, which is the app that I use to make this podcast, to leave a voicemail for the 100th episode. And if you leave one, I will play it next week's show. I've got a couple of people who have done it. All you have to do is download the Anchor app, A-N-C-O-R. It's called Anchor FM. It's quite easy to do. Find the Unknown Passage page on there and hit leave a voicemail, and then they come through to me and I will play them on the 100th episode. Just say your name, who you are. You don't have to be a patron to do it either. I just thought it would be a cool idea, and I'd love to hear your voices and your accents as well. So when I posted the preview of this, you know, when I'd posted part one on Patreon, pretty much instantly, which has never happened before, a bunch of you commented, oh my God, I know this case. This is the worst case ever. So I think that quite a lot of people know the Mark Kilroy case. Also, I realized after doing all the research for part one and two, that actually one of my favorite podcasts, Last Podcast on the Left, did a three-parter on Adolphe Constanzo, who is basically the ringleader of the cult that murdered Mark Kilroy. And I went back, it was 4:30, 4:31 and 4:32. I've listened to pretty much every one of their episodes bar about 20. And that was one of the ones that I hadn't listened to because I'd kind of gone off the whole cult thing. Anyway, I listened to most of it. Obviously, the boys like go off on tangents with comedy and things, and I really just wanted to get to the nuts and bolts of it. Theirs is all about Adolphe Constanzo. So if you want like a 5-hour deep dive into him, his history, his cult, and all the different players, go and listen to that. I'm trying to keep this more about Mark Kilroy, and he only features on a little bit of their third part. But there are a couple of things that Marcus Parks found during his research with Henry Zebrowski that I found was interesting, and I do trust their research. So when it comes to that, I will bring it up. So where we left off, Mark Kilroy had gone down to South Padre Island for spring break with three of his friends. They had crossed the border to Matamoros, a border city on the Mexican side of the Rio Grande, and he was last seen walking up the street towards the bridge to go back to their car in Brownsville on the US side of the border. And then his friends did not see him again, and he just kind of disappeared into thin air as all of the spring breakers and tourists were spilling out into the streets. Now, what really happened to Mark is terrible, and I never really feel like I have to say this, but in this instance, I just want to say that if you're kind of not good with details of torture, which I think is probably most of us, but if it really upsets you, maybe don't listen to this part, because a lot of it is to do with human sacrifice, who the cult was, a couple of their leaders. But I won't do the deep dive that Marcus, Ben and Henry obviously did, because that's like 5 hours, but I'll hit the major points. So basically, where we left off, the last part was that a number of the members of the cult had been arrested. They had found 15 tortured and desecrated bodies on the ranch, which is Rancho Santa Elena. And they were investigating, basically, and were able to identify one of those through dental records as American tourist Mark Kilroy. So what I'm going to tell you now is what happened to Mark once he vanished from that main street in Matamoros. And this was kind of told by a number of people who were arrested, including Serafine Hernandez Garcia and Mario Fabio Ponce Torres. So as Mark and his friends were walking up the main drag towards the bridge that goes over to Brownsville, they were right, his friends Brad and Bill, who under hypnosis, Brad was able to remember a man with a scar on his face standing near a parked red truck with kind of like a flatbed back, who kind of motioned to Mark and called him over. And according to their recollections of this tiny moment in their whole night, he had said something like, "Do I know you?" or something like that. Now, every part of my research, and I've read a ton as going back as far as articles from 1989, indicates that Mark was grabbed as he got close to the vehicle. But when I listened to the last podcast, part three, about Mark, they said that they had offered him a lift and he said yes because he was drunk, which actually I never like questioned Marcus or Henry's research. But in this instance, I don't think that's right. I do think that they abducted him and dragged him because he was walking with his friends. They had offered him a lift, these random guys, to the bridge. But why would he do that when he was walking with his friends? And I've never seen that anywhere. So I'm just interested to see where that came from. Now, depending on what part you believe, a couple of blocks away, once he was in the car and restrained, according to the guys on last podcast on the left, it was now in their version of events that Mark started to get a feeling that something wasn't quite right and kind of fled from the car. That in all other instances where he'd been restrained, about two blocks down, he was able to get loose and kind of flee from this truck. And Mark was quite tall. He was athletic. He was sporty. And from everything I can tell, from now on, it's the same story. He was able to break loose. But basically another car came out of nowhere and kind of cut him off, because the guys from the truck started running after him and he was cut off. Now, this is another kind of instance of, I haven't read this anywhere, but according to last podcast, who I do trust their research because they're so good at it, they said that this car pulled up and the men got out and identified themselves as plainclothes policemen who were arresting Mark for drunk and disorderly behavior in public, and that Mark willingly went with them. But everything that I've read says that he was, you know, he got out, he sprang free, he was able to run. One of the people chasing him from the truck kind of lost his breath, and then this car came out and was able to corner him so that they were able to catch up to him. So I'm not sure whether or not they were saying that they were police, but according to the guys on last podcast, he went willingly, but kind of that's not what I've read from most things. But ultimately, both this truck and this car were run by like kind of allies from the same cult. Now, Mark was taken back. He was held in the truck, I believe in the flatbed part of it, and he was restrained. Most sources say he was handcuffed. He was driven out of Matamoros to a rural area just outside of town, which is about 1 mile from the Rio Grande and the US border. And this is where the ranch is, which is called Rancho Santa Elena, which is the one that they had found all the bodies on that we covered in part one. Most sources indicate that Mark was left restrained in the truck overnight. According to the last podcast, he was left for like almost 24 hours in the bed of the truck and restrained. I'm sure that it was more than handcuffing if he was able, you know, to not move. It must have been he was also tied at the feet and things like that. Now, the ranch's caretaker, who I guess most of you will ask why he didn't report this, but I do understand why he didn't, he saw Mark held there and restrained, and he actually bought him bread, scrambled eggs, and some water to drink. Now, he never reported this ultimately. He would ultimately hand them in when they were all arrested, but I understand why he wouldn't, because when we get into the kinds of people that were operating on this ranch, you would be in self-preservation mode knowing what they were up to on it. So I really kind of feel for this old caretaker. Ultimately, he did the right thing later on and would hand them in, but it's kind of just a moment of humanity because honestly, they would have killed him if he'd been able to let Mark Kilroy go. The next day, Mark was moved to a little kind of storage cabin / shack on the property, which had all of their cult paraphernalia in, which I will get into, and it would be where they would do their sacrifices of animals and the like. So as his friends were waking up the following day in South Padre Island and realizing Mark still wasn't there, around the same time he was being led into this shack. Most sources say he was held for 12 hours. I think it must have been over that because he was left for like a whole day in the truck before being moved to this shack. And when they moved him to this is where the ritual murder commences. Ultimately, he would be held throughout the following night. While probably the alarm had been raised by his friends, and probably when his friends had gone back across to Matamoros with police looking for him, he was castrated while he was still alive. He was sodomized throughout the night, and there's not a whole lot more out there about what happened to Mark. It actually, most sources don't say the castration part. Last podcast said that he was while he was still alive. Finally, kind of in the wee hours of the morning, he was led outside to a field, which is essentially this cult's killing fields. And Adolfo Constanzo, the head of this cult, El Padrino, as he's known as the Godfather, killed Mark by chopping the back of his head and neck with a machete. Now, Seraphine, who had been one of the ones who had lured Mark to the truck, the one with the scars on his faces, was right nearby, and according to last podcast on the left, he heard this machete chop to the top of the head because it basically took off the top of his head so that his brains were left exposed. And Seraphine said it sounded like a coconut being cracked open. According to Texas Monthly, quote, the ceremony went like this. First, the high priest offered up the sacrifice, cutting the victim's throat, or in Mark Kilroy's case, taking off the top of his head with a machete. So the high priest is Adolfo Constanzo, who I will be talking about quite at length shortly. His brain and his heart were then put in the Nganga, which is the big cast iron pot that was pretty much at this point overflowing with animal remains and everything that I kind of mentioned in part one. And the human remains were added to that. In order to bury him, because they hadn't dug a hole big enough, they actually removed Mark Kilroy's legs, starting by chopping off his feet and then taking off his legs above his knees. When the body would be found, police would think this was part of the ritual, but in fact, it was just to facilitate the burial of Mark Kilroy. One of the worst parts of this is that a wire was inserted into Mark's spinal cord post-death, and basically this wire, when they filled him in his grave, it was left exposed hanging out of the top. So basically the point of it was that once he was fully decomposed and just skeletonized, they would pull this wire and it would pull out his spinal cord so that they could then wear that as, you know, jewelry around their necks. In part one, I said that some police said that when they arrived, they, you know, members of the cult who were on the ranch were wearing spinal cords. That was not Mark's. I don't know if that is true or if that was the media going crazy with the story, which they did both in Mexico and in the USA. I'm not entirely sure. So let's talk about the cult. So the cult had been set up that night to find a gringo, a white guy. Costanzo had sent them out to find a young white man with probably like an intellectual type, and you can probably tell those types. You know, Costanzo wanted them to get an all-American who had an American brain, from everything I can find, to sacrifice and then stew in the Nganga. Now, Seraphine, who would ultimately confess to everything, was one of the abductors of Mark, who ran the police checkpoint and unwittingly led the police who were doing a drug bust to the ranch. So how long this would have gone on for had he not done that, we just don't know. And finally, they were able to get answers in April to where Mark Kilroy was, which would have been just a terrible month-long struggle for his family and friends. On the 9th of April 1989, they returned to the ranch once again, and they were at this ranch searching for a very long time. This is when they continued to arrest further cult members and the ranch's caretaker who had fed Mark the bread, eggs and water. And actually the first couple of times they went, they didn't find the cabin with all their Nganga and the ritual stuff. It was only later. Now, the detainees, of which there were quite a lot, but they were still looking for the ringleader and a couple of other ones that I will be talking about. They were all sent to prison, and by all accounts, they were very relaxed because what they believed that they had done, they really, really did believe this. So the caretaker was ultimately interrogated and told the police what he had seen happening at the ranch, that a lot of criminals, you know, had come to the ranch, and that he, you know, believed that people were being murdered and the ranch was pretty much a dumping ground. But he believed it was, you know, gang rivals and things like that, which for the most part, other than Mark Kilroy's murder, it was. Ultimately, the ranch's caretaker was able to identify Mark Kilroy through a photograph of a missing poster that was pinned up in the police station. And the caretaker said, "Yeah, I saw him," and then pointed at a photo of the shack on the ranch. Ultimately, Mark was identified through dental records because obviously the way I've described his state of his body, you wouldn't be identifying him any other way. The rest of the 15 found on the ranch, Rancho Santa Elena, were drug and gang rivals. And Santa Elena, which I think is a really nice name, which probably means Saint Elena, was used as a dumping ground of sorts, along with, you know, a sacrificial burial ground. The ranch continued to be searched, and the Mexican police also seized a lot of drugs because that's kind of how this cult, the believers, I guess they would be known as to themselves, made their money, which was a lot of it. They seized 110 kilos of marijuana, which is around 243 pounds, 108 grams of cocaine, 12 firearms, including three submachine guns, and 11 vehicles, some of which had, you know, car phones, which in 1989 was like the peak of, you know, people thought, oh my God, they're rich if they've got a car phone. Now, inside the iron pot, which was the Nagunga, investigators found parts of a human brain, which was Mark's, a goat's head, chicken feet, a turtle, a horseshoe, several herbs and coins mixed with animal blood. But they were pretty certain to say that there's no signs of cannibalism. But as we get into how these operate, it doesn't seem that they cannibalize this. It's more of an offering to their gods. Texas Monthly, quote, "Reporters tied handkerchiefs across their faces as they stepped inside the Devil's Cathedral, a small shed with a tin roof and red tar paper walls. The air was foul and thick. On the concrete floor were the remains of an altar and the accoutrements of black magic, black candles, cigar butts, bottles of a cheap cane liquor known as aguardiente. There were also white candles, peppers, and pods of garlic used by the white magician brought in by the commandant to purify the site," unquote. Now, as we've kind of said happens in parts of the world on previous cases, the suspects were paraded in front of the media for a photo opportunity. They were forced to stand on a balcony. I will put up pictures of this. It's not very secure, like they could have easily been pushed off and died, as photographs were taken and the press shouted questions to them. Many of the cult leaders who had been arrested thus far, which I won't go into every single one, but if you are interested in all of their different stories, because quite a lot of them were educated and had, you know, university degrees, last podcast on the left goes into all of them. Many of them had been branded with hot blades or scarred as part of their initiation into this gang. By the time the ringleader Constanzo, you know, what, by the time the ranch had been searched and they had found the body, the ringleader Constanzo, that everyone was very eager to toss the blame onto, was gone. And they put out, you know, an international arrest warrant for him. He had fled across the border to Brownsville, just on the other side, which we've talked about, and checked into a Holiday Inn with a number of other members of the cult and higher-ups. He then went to McAllen, Texas, and flew to Mexico City, where he had an apartment. And actually, he had apartments all over the place, Miami, Mexico City, the border cities. It was crazy. Crime really does pay. So he had escaped with a girl called Sarah Eldrete, a guy called Martin Quintana Rodriguez, Omar Francisco Aria Ochia, and Alvaro de Leon Valdez, which he's known as El Dubi. And if you want to hear a lot about him, listen to the last podcast episode because he's really interesting in his own right. On the family front, on April 13th, a memorial was held for Mark in his hometown of Santa Fe, Texas. His parents at the time were in Brownsville, kind of on the other side of the border, waiting for news, and a memorial with thousands of people were held there. Their faith is really what saw the Kilroys through, which is, I think I've talked about before, something that I kind of envy in people who have faith. Basically, his mother had told people to pray for the murderers, which is more than I would ever say. Around this time, Mark Kilroy's friends really openly stated that they'd wish they'd just stayed in South Padre Island and partied, you know, but you can say all this all you want, but it generally doesn't happen. This is such a rare instance, and, you know, I hope they didn't go through the rest of their lives blaming themselves, you know, wherever they are. On the 15th of April, Mark Kilroy's parents met with the then US President George H.W. Bush. And really, this meeting focused a lot on the drug trade and a war on drugs, because they really saw the drugs as the center of all of these crimes, which I myself believe, which on previous episodes, you'd probably know that. Now, 2 weeks after the bodies were exhumed on Rancho Santa Elena, the Mexican federal police did something that would be very controversial, but I actually think that this is because they're quite spiritual people and were quite fearful of dark entities on the ranch. Remember, people in Mexico and other parts of the world are quite supernatural and superstitious with these kinds of things. So in the early hours of the morning, they went to the ranch, basically doused it in gasoline, and set the whole ranch, you know, and the cabin on fire. They lay a wooden cross across the ashes. Now, they apparently took someone called a curandero, which is a folk healer, to do a purification ritual on the shack before burning it down. So this involved prayers, sprinkling salt across it, and, you know, then doing the mark of the cross. And they were kind of scared, as last podcast talks about it, because when it burnt down, this cast iron Nganga was still standing, which obviously, and they were kind of very scared of it. Now, most places in the world would not burn down the center of where the evidence would be. And later on, they would kind of use this as a number of the cult leaders as an example of why it was a corrupt investigation and how they were innocent because evidence was destroyed. Now, the reason that the Mexican federal police burnt this down was very interesting. So they consulted an anthropologist, someone who, you know, studies society and people. And basically they had told them if they burn down the shack, it will kind of destroy the main ringleader, who they didn't know where he was at that point, Costanzo, because it's the center of his world, this ranch where he's taking all these people, which when we talk about his life, I will talk about that. And it means so much to him. Now, where he was at the time when this happened was holed up in one of his apartments in Mexico City, unbeknownst to the police. And him and his people saw it on TV, and he went mental for like an hour, screaming and crying. And then he shot like a whole clip of a gun into the TV. So the anthropologist was right that it would kind of unsteady him in a way, which is, you know, a really interesting thing. So who are these cult leaders, and how did they come to be so powerful in regards to the people that are under them? So Adolfo de Jesus Costanzo was from a Cuban family. He was born to a teenage mother who was 15 at the time of his birth, in Miami, Florida, on November 1st, 1962. He's a Scorpio, and he definitely acts like one. At the time of Mark's murder, he would have been around 27, and he was known by 27 as the godfather of Matamoros, which is El Padrino de Matamoros. When he was a child, a young child, his father died. And I find it very interesting to talk about the parallels between Mark Kilroy's very stable, religious, solid life with a close family, and the early makings, I guess, of a psychopath in Adolfo Costanzo. So when his father died when he was young, his mother, who would have only been barely into adulthood, moved to Puerto Rico with him, where she remarried. After some time, her and the new husband and Adolfo returned to Miami, and it was there that his stepfather died too. Now, he left quite a large inheritance to the two behind, which I guess Adolfo would use to buy a number of his properties and do quite a lot of his dirty work later on. Constanzo was actually a baptized Catholic and altar boy growing up, but unfortunately his mother's third marriage, when she still would have been really young, to a man who was involved in the occult practices and drug trafficking, would put an end to any altar boy fantasies. This third stepfather basically taught Adolfo Constanzo from an early age a number of different sub-religions, I guess, that are practiced in communities across the world. Now, his new stepfather's influence basically had his mother start thinking that Adolfo was psychic, and according to a lot of people who were around him, you know, he was. But if you study cult leaders and, you know, look into how people rise to power, you know, Hitler, Stalin, major dictators, Jim Jones, Charles Manson, you have to understand that they may think that he's got psychic abilities, but he's probably just dealing with people who are of sub-intelligence, really, because they pick their victims very carefully. He's probably more of a narcissist or a sociopath than he is of a psychic or a clairvoyant. So when he was a teenager, his mother took him on various trips to Haiti, which is kind of the birthplace of voodoo, to study that. And you can see all of this is really the opposite of Mark Kilroy's safe, stable and religious upbringing in quite a God-fearing part of Texas. As a child, Adolfo was introduced by his mother and the third stepfather to a number of Caribbean, African, Cuban sub-religions, I guess, that promote animal sacrifice. One of these is called Santeria, which is a Cuban started, but they practice it in Africa, religion that really worships deities. I had to really slim it down because there's so much about these. In short, its followers call themselves believers, hence his later cult name, and also the obsession with the movie The Believers that came out in 1987, which is actually based in New York. But when they would recruit people later on to his cult, he would make them watch this movie like over and over and over again. In Santeria, the followers of this, I think they call it a dysphoric, how do you say it, religion? In Santeria, they believe that humans have links to their own unique deities who influence who that person will become and what they will end up doing with their life. And followers of it make offerings to the deities in the form of usually fruit, flowers, or sometimes sacrificed animals. And a lot of it involves drumming and summoning the Orica, I think is how you say it, which is these deities or the head of the deities. The dead to Santeria followers can be communicated with and should be respected. And you can kind of see how Adolfo Constanzo really just is one of those people that just picks and chooses the parts of a religion that kind of suit him and then just completely ignores, you know, the rest of them. Now, one of the religions that Adolfo Constanzo was very interested in from an early age was one called Palo Mayombe, which they talk quite at length about in the last podcast on the left episode. So this is an Afro-Caribbean religion that he was introduced to at a very young age, which also worships deities in a sense. Central to the practice of Palo Mayombe, which I'll just call Palo, is the Nganga, which is the cast iron metal pot. Basically, Palo means sticks. So they put into this cauldron or pot human bones, sticks, other kind of offerings to these deities. So the Nganga is believed to be the spirit of a dead individual who then goes on to be the slave of the person who killed them. And the Nganga is then fed with the blood of these sacrificed, usually male animals. So obviously you can kind of put together in your head how you get to sacrificing humans, because Most practitioners of this stop at animal bones, but actually for about 100 years, people have very regularly, including in Mexico, procured human graves by grave robbing. But ultimately, Adolfo's belief was that if you could get fresher bones from a just dead person, it's better than old human bones from a grave. In 1984, when Adolfo was in his early 20s, he moved to Mexico City and he worked as a tarot card reader in like a strip mall. He was very kind of low down on the totem pole at that point. And I guess I should add that he's quite a good looking dude. There's pictures of him that are very late 80s. He's again got that kind of same hairstyle as Mark Kilroy, which we would have called like a mullet in Australia, late 80s hairdo. Someone tell me what you call it in America. He was charismatic, which most of these leaders are. Otherwise, they would never have followers. So Jim Jones, most cult leaders, that Keith Raniere, the guy who just got done for that Nexium cult, he had good looks. So in pictures, he's wearing kind of long-sleeved, nice shirts that are very bright green and purple, very late 80s. Top three buttons, you know, are undone. He's got his gold chains on. And there's pictures of him working as a model, which he did on and off as well. So between that, his charisma, psychic talents that he professed to have, and now his highest position as high priest of the Palo Mayombe religion, people flocked to Adolfo Constanzo. And he developed a bit of a cult following in Mexico City where he would frequent. He claimed to have been able to predict the future. And one of the things that he offered was this ritual cleansing. And a lot of his regular customers were police officers. So he had connections there, drug dealers and musicians. But it is very important to note that he was not in a cartel, and the cartels like would have laughed at him. His cult was very much like small fries compared to that. And I think the cartels of these days would have been like, no, you're not going to be part of this. He was really just moving a lot of drugs and getting into some really dark stuff. And I don't find him particularly interesting at all, but people, including the last podcast guys, think he's, you know, fascinating, but they're very interested in the supernatural element. I'm really not. I'm more interested in like the human element. So it was here in Mexico that Adolfo Constanzo's beliefs in the power of the Nganga turned to finding a human to sacrifice, in short. He started to raid graveyards for human bones to put in the Nganga, but then he decided with his small cult following that the spirits of the dead would be stronger if you used just recently dead or live human sacrifices instead of the old human bones that had been in a grave. Long story short, in 1988, Adolfo Constanzo moved to Rancho Santa Elena that was owned actually by someone he knew but wasn't involved in any of these crimes, which was a house that was about 1 mile from the bridge that goes across to Brownsville and just outside of the city of Matamoros. Its location would basically make it perfect through industrial yards and then rural kind of fields. So he would take people there to torture and kill mainly rival drug dealers who were stomping on his turf. But it was also a place where he could store the masses of drugs that him and his cult were collecting. Ultimately, when this all broke, the news of Mark Kilroy's death and the arrests of all of these people and the hunt for Adolfo Constanzo and others, the Mexican media dubbed this group Los Narcos Satanicos. So I guess the drug Satanists. Now, as Henry pointed out in last podcast on the left, this form of human sacrifice and the Nganga and all of that Palo Mayombe, it's the real shit. It's not the, you know, West Memphis 3, what the US, you know, the McMartin preschool, what the US were trying to push in the late 80s, early 90s, trying to make it look like, you know, the West Memphis 3 were Satanists, this stuff would have scared the shit out of them, because as much as I don't think any of it is real, to them, you know, it probably was. Whether or not it works is a whole other thing, but their intentions, I guess, were real. Surely, I think there must have been people who were lower down in this cult who were like, oh, what the fuck are they doing? Do they seriously think this works? But I do actually think that Adolfo Constanzo, to a point, thought it worked. But to a point, I think that he was using it to just control people, which is the mark of like a true narcissist or sociopath. The second largest cult leader that was currently missing was actually a woman called Sarah Eldrete. She was actually born in Matamoros on September 6, 1964. She was a Virgo and Constanzo was a Scorpio. And that is one of the most powerful, if you're into that kind of stuff, connections there is. I'm a Virgo. I was always drawn to Scorpios. They say it's like the perfect balance, which I thought was really interesting when I was researching this. She was born as Sarah Maria Eldrete Villarreal on September 6, 1964. And she grew up, you know, middle class in Matamoros. She would attend high school across the Rio Grande in Brownsville, Texas. So she would every day cross the bridge into the United States to go to high school and then college. And she was very switched on. She's not the ideal candidate, I don't think, to get into this. You would never suspect it. But ultimately, she would come to be known as El Madrino, which means the godmother, to Costanzo's El Padrino, which is the godfather. Now, Sarah was kind of quite a domineering presence. She was 6'1", which is very tall. She was a cheerleader for a soccer team at her university, which was called Texas Southmost College, which is TSC, they call it. A straight-A student, friendly. They said she was eager to please in Texas Monthly. They said she never missed school. And when the truth of what she was involved in came out, including procuring people for Adolfo Constanzo and his goons to kill, whether or not you think she was actually involved in it or not, people were shocked. They couldn't believe it. Texas Monthly talks about how she would go home every day to Matamoros from Brownsville and cross the border, and she would pray before, quote, blood splattered altar, unquote. The police ultimately believe that she took part in at least one human sacrifice, and this was of a man that had insulted her. So she lured him to the ranch and supervised a slow death, quote, that included cutting off his nipples with scissors and boiling him alive, unquote. So she is a dangerous bitch. She was super into the occult from a young age, very in line with Adolfo Constanzo, although she had more of a stable upbringing and would go on to go to university, at least for a time in Brownsville, and would be trying to improve her life. She was getting a physical education, like scholarship. You just can't believe that these women are involved in it. And ultimately, she clicked in with Adolfo Constanzo and the drug trade through Serafine Hernandez Garcia, who we've talked about previously, who attended college with her, and his uncle, Elio Hernandez Rivera, who she would date for a time. So Texas Monthly talks about how Sarah Eldrete lived a double life. On one side of the border, on the US side, she was a bubbly cheerleader with a bright future ahead of her. And on the other side, she was a woman who always wore black, was kind of very tall, domineering, and brutal. So ultimately, Uncle Elio Hernandez Rivera, who she would date for a time, was the one who at one time oversaw the massive drug operation in Matamoros. But when he was assassinated in 1987, his brother took over because the cult kind of needed it. And then in short, again, if you want to know the ins and outs of all of this, listen to the last podcast, 430 episode. In short, they became really entranced with Adolfo Constanzo, who was a bit player in all of this. And he rose to the top. So he's like the high priest in his Palo Mayombe. And he's now running the entire drug operation. He really achieved quite a lot by the time he was 28. So as I've said, the border of the US and Mexico was 1 mile from Rancho Santa Elena. So now that he was kind of based there, they could move drugs into the US, you know, with ease. And it was all kind of very easy with the Rio Grande right there. Now, once the murder of Mark Kilroy happened and, you know, Adolfo Constanzo sacrificed him, Adolfo Constanzo, Sarah Eldrete, and a number of other players who I'm not really going to talk about in length with this, fled to Mexico City. Now, tips came in that they were seen all over the place. New Mexico, Chicago, the police searched for them in Miami because of Adolfo's connections to growing up in Miami. But ultimately, they would raid a number of his properties because he had a shitload of properties, including in border cities like Juarez. So in one of them, in Matamoros, they discovered an altar and several, you know, religious images. And in another, they were also able to find like gay porn and things like that. And then they ultimately turned to like the gay population in that part of Mexico who may have known him because he kind of like, I think, was bisexual. Police stated that at one of the raids that they did on one of his properties, the house's interior was covered with blood. Now, ultimately, they would find him in a really kind of unrelated way. Sarah Eldrete, I think at this point, really wanted out. She had realized what she had gotten into, that they were looking for her, and she really kind of was in self-preservation mode. I don't think because she felt bad for what she had done or was involved with. I think it was because she wanted to save herself and was like, fuck everyone else. So basically, she was in a property in Mexico City with Adolfo and El Dubi and some others, and she threw like a letter out the window, which is basically like saying a woman is being held hostage here and send the police. Now, it's all very confusing how this came to be, but ultimately the police were called to that apartment for an unrelated dispute, like unrelated to the fact that these people were murderers. And they parked outside in like an unmarked vehicle, but Adolfo Constanzo looked outside and he noticed, he knew what an unmarked vehicle looked like because they had like serial numbers on the side. So he was like, oh fuck, like they found me. And he just opened fire immediately with a machine gun and was like, you know, it's on. Ultimately, he wouldn't have even been arrested, like, because they didn't exactly know where this letter had come from that Sarah Eldrete had put out the window. Cult member Alvaro de Leon Valdez told the New York Times, or told authorities who told the New York Times, quote, he grabbed a bundle of money and threw it and began shooting out the window. He said everything was lost, unquote. So it's really like the tail end of the movie Scarface. Now, this gun battle went on for 45 minutes until Adolfo and his goons ran out of, what do you call them, magazines. They only had two left. So basically he was like, you have to kill me. Previously, for the last couple of months while they were on the run, they had kind of floated the idea of a suicide pact. Sarah Eldrete was not kind of down for that. Neither was El Dubi. So in this instance, they knew that they were, you know, out of rounds and the police were going to bust in and probably kill them all. So he handed the gun to one of his followers, Alvaro de Leon, and he basically said to him to kill him and Martin Quintana, who was also there. And he did. He emptied the whole thing, you know, into them. So Adolfo Constanzo would never kind of face the music for what he had done. By the time the police reached the apartment, it was very obvious which one it was coming from. Both of them were dead. El Dubi sat down on the floor and just waited for the police to come. And so did Sarah Eldrete, because both of them were like, I don't want to die, when it came down to it, even though they had been, you know, bringing people to the ranch to die. I find that really interesting about the human condition, especially when people like don't want to go on, they offer up a confession for a multiple murder so that they get life in prison and not the death penalty. They're like fearful of death, but they're willing to put like other people through it. I find it really interesting. But according to the Washington Post, quote, Constanzo faced death with unblinking indifference. Literally, the autopsy revealed that a bullet had pierced his eye, but not his eyelid. Don't worry, Constanzo is alleged to have said right before he died, I'll be back, unquote. So he was just staring at the dude as he kills him. He hadn't even shut his eyes. De Leon, El Dubi, and Sarah Eldrete were immediately arrested at the scene. She was arrested as she tried to flee the apartment. She told authorities, quote, he said, let's all die, but I didn't want to die, unquote. So she chooses the wrong men. Now, she really went on to distance herself from all of the men, Constanzo, and claimed to have been an innocent in all of this. When she was asked if she loved Constanzo, she said that it wasn't like that. She just admired him, even though most sources think that, you know, she was one of his, you know, sexual minions. She would later say that the police burnt down the ranch to be able to frame them and to get rid of any evidence, that she wasn't sorry because she didn't do anything wrong, and that she was ultimately tortured to confess. Now, as last podcast on the left talk about, this actually isn't probably too far from the truth. This is like a Mexican way of interrogating people. I can't remember what it is in Spanish, but it's like moral interrogation. Basically, the police take soda water and they put Tabasco sauce in it. I can't even believe I'm saying this. They shake it up and they squirt it up the nose of the person, which would be fucking excruciating. But it gets the confession out. But I think in this instance, confession or no confession, they had them like dead to rights. Now, if you're wondering what happened to all of these people, because obviously Adolfo Constanzo, who had killed, you know, been behind all of this, killed Mark Kilroy, like cut the top of his head off with a machete. It's just all so brutal. He never was able to face it because he was a pussy and, you know, said, kill me, because he wasn't going to face jail. So they went to trial, and on the 3rd of May 1994, Sara Aldrete was sentenced to 62 years in prison. Ultimately, it would come down to around, I think, 40 or so that she would have to serve. Cult members Elio, who, you know, the uncle that she'd been going out with, Serafine, Martinez Salinas, and Serena Valdez. There's so many of these that I just haven't got into because I really wanted to focus this episode mostly on Mark Kilroy. Again, listen to last podcast if you want to hear all of this. They all received 67 years each. Isn't it weird that women, well, it's not weird, it's just the system. Women always get less, even if they're more involved. Like, ladies, if we want equality, can we get the same sentences and not claim to be innocent? So in an interview with the press, Mark Kilroy's parents said that they were relieved that it was over and that they had been sentenced, you know, for their crimes. This had gone on for over 5 years at this point. There's got to be, I don't believe in closure, but you would hope for an element of that, you know, by this point. They were all charged with multiple homicide, possession of narcotics, involvement in organized crime, impersonation of police officers, illegal body desecration, illegal possession of firearms, and illegal possession of weapons exclusive to the Mexican armed forces. Now, the police impersonation is what makes me think that the last podcast on the left guys were right, that the guys who kind of cut Mark off when he had escaped the truck in the first place had claimed to be police officers. But then again, they could have been claiming to be police officers for years. So the maximum conviction a person in Mexico can get for capital murder is 50 years. But ultimately, with all of those charges, that is how they were able to get them. But they are able over the years. There's no parole in the Mexico system, but they are able to file motions to get little parts of their sentence kind of taken off. On the 27th of March 1998, a Mexican federal court reduced the sentences of three of the kind of lower down players by 17 years, which lowered their sentences from 67 to 50 years. As of 2009, two suspects involved in the murder of Mark Kilroy for the Believers cult remain at large, Ovidio and Ponce Torres, and they've never been found. If you want a kind of silver lining for this, I guess, the Mark Kilroy Foundation was founded by Mark's parents in 1989 and is still in existence today. It promotes drug awareness, education, and prevention through the various campaigns that they do. It also contributes to young people's dreams because Mark Kilroy was in pre-med and he hoped to become a doctor. So a lot of people are sponsored by this program. And about 500 young people each year go to camp with all these different activities, like a summer camp, because Mark Kilroy's parents believe that basically people get into these kinds of crimes because they're bored. And as someone who has seen people get into these kinds of crimes in terms of with drugs, it is boredom. It's usually unemployment. It's in areas where there's nothing to keep young people involved in things. They're not involved in community. And it only gets worse now because young people are more and more less about community. They're not hanging out with their friends outside. When I was growing up, we used to play water fights and cricket out in the street until 8 o'clock at night when we would have to go inside right from when we got home from school. And when do you ever see that happening anymore? Kids are obsessed with the internet and screens, and they're regressing a lot more in terms of mentally, I've noticed. And I think initiatives like the Mark Kilroy Foundation, you know, are fantastic because they have it right. The Mark Kilroy Foundation also advises young people who are travelling, especially for spring break, to, you know, watch out for each other. Although I think in this instance with the four guys, there's nothing they could do. Mark was taken, you know, so quickly. He was right there with his friends and then he wasn't. They also kind of suggest that tourists should check travel warnings, which I often talk about on these episodes, and abide by foreign laws, and just to be careful when you're going to places like Mexico, even though Matamoros is not somewhere that people go anymore. In the end, opting to kill Mark Kilroy ended Adolfo Constanzo's cult, his riches, and his big dreams, I guess, of, you know, running everywhere in Mexico. They chose a guy that had connections. His uncle, Ken, you know, with his connections at customs in LA, was able to get the ball rolling on this. And as a result of Mark being young, good-looking, white, and had a bright future ahead of him, it hit the national news in the States and shocked people, and international news as well. And it was Adolfo Constanzo's downfall, wanting to get a smart, good-looking gringo from the United States. According to a Washington Post article from 1991, quote, 30 additional murders in other parts of Mexico, including 16 ritually killed children under the age of 16 that are catalogued in this account as suspected but not proven, have now been attributed to the high priest, unquote. So he was a serial killer and one of the worst of the worst. Sara Aldrete is now 56 and she's still in prison in Mexico. Just last year in 2020, Sara Aldrete issued a formal petition to be released because she had served 31 years in prison. She also wrote a book, which, please don't buy it. Henry on last podcast was talking about he wants a copy of it. Don't buy these things and don't give these people the press or the money out of it. And if they do make money out of it, it should be considered proceeds of crime and it should go to the Mark Kilroy Foundation. Her expected release date, if she's not granted early release, will be in 2039. But if Sara Aldrete is ever released from prison, American authorities plan to prosecute her on the other side of the border for the murder of Mark Kilroy, because it is literally 1 mile away from where it happened in Matamoros. So that is the story of Mark Kilroy. Fucked, isn't it? Yeah, a lot of you were like, this is so demented and fucking horrible. I think it's a good reminder that as much as people think women are mostly victims of things, actually young men between the ages of 18 and 35 are the most at risk of being victims. And I know this because when I was in uni, my minor is in criminology and I studied a unit called, what was it called? Victimology. And we talked extensively about how young men are more likely to be victims at the hands of other young men. So, you know, look out for your young men. And I wish that most of them got more press. So, yeah, visit the website. It's back up at unknownpassagepodcast.com. Become a patron. It links off the website. Download the app. Search for Unknown Passage. There's a number of different tiers and you get to choose a location of choice for an upcoming episode. It may take a few months because I've got a lot on the list, but I always do get to them. One-off donations to the podcast and its upkeep to PayPal, unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com. I said that weird, I might say it again. On PayPal, you can do it. Send it to unknownpassagepodcast@gmail.com and leave a rating or review. If you like the show, there was a really good one that someone posted and it was like, Do I like all of her commentary? No. But do you want your own opinions regurgitated to you all the fucking time? Which is so true. Like, if you want to live in an echo chamber, fine. Just don't listen to this podcast. So the next episode is my 100th episode, and I will be playing a few voicemails from you guys. Please do it if you can, because I want to hear your voices. I already have a couple. I will play them throughout the episode. But I decided to do something special for the 100th. I'll still be doing an episode, but the case of why I started this podcast, I still have not done, which is insane. This girl's case, no one will know her name. It's not well known, and there's very little out there about it. But when I heard, like about 2 years ago, I was on an Australian website and her name came up, and I thought, oh, she went missing overseas, and it must have been really hard to get information, like, or to communicate for her family when she was missing in such a remote place. And then as it kind of stewed more and more, and I thought, God, that would be a really interesting podcast if, you know, people who went missing overseas and the challenges, you know, associated with that, and people might learn a bit about geography and things like that. So yeah, I'm going to do her case, which will be, I'll be stepping away from the Patreon location requests for that episode. And then I will be back. Yeah, I've got some interesting things planned. Yeah, I'll keep you posted. So yeah, I will talk to you soon. Cinnamon is sitting here. She didn't like that case at all. I had to cover her ears. Yeah, so I'll talk to you soon, guys. Thanks so much. Bye.